Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello. Welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Coming up shortly, you can hear my chat with Phil Yates, looking ahead to the British Open. We've gone through the first round draw, picking some of the highlights, and there are plenty of highlights. It's very interesting, of course, an open draw, so that's coming up shortly. No drama this week. I'm going to get straight in to the emails, although just before that, I want to say thank you for all the emails that you've sent, many of them supporting the podcast. If you do listen on Apple Podcasts and you enjoy what you hear, you can leave us a review on there, and that gives other people the opportunity to find the podcast, because still people are writing in saying, oh, I've only just discovered this podcast, and you know, we've been going for 6 years, so that tells you that obviously in the overcrowded podcast world, it's not always easy to stand out. So if you can do that, that would be appreciated. Don't have to, but anyway, we move on. I'm going to get straight into the emails. We start with Adam Wareham. He asks a very direct question: why isn't the Masters a ranking event? I know that in the past the format has been different, and wildcards have been announced to allow crowd favourites to appear who may not deserve to be there on current form. But I believe that for many years now, the format has been to invite the top 16 players to appear. When Ronnie declined a couple of years ago, his place went to Ali Carter, who was then ranked 17th. That seems sensible. None of this sounds too dissimilar to the format for the Players' Championship, where the top 16 on the one-year list qualify, or the Tour Championship, where the top 8 qualify. Surely elevating the Masters to a ranking event would only increase its prestige, so why does it remain a non-ranking event? Am I missing something? And on a different topic, why has Stephen Hendry not entered the Championship League? If he wants to fulfil his dream of making a final Crucible appearance later this season, surely he needs competitive games. Well, on that latter point, I mean, I think Stephen was quite clear. He said he wanted to play in front of audiences. They don't have audiences at the Championship League. I tend to agree, though. If he wants to be competitive, he has to play as much as possible. And certainly, I hope he'll play more snooker this season than he did last year. He entered the Gibraltar Open and the World Championship last year, or last season. He's in the British Open. He's playing Chris Wakelin, so that's a good chance to see him in, just a few days' time. But on the point about the Masters, well, this has been asked a few times. Strictly speaking, it's not actually like the Players' Championship and the Tour Championship for this reason. On a one-year list, everyone has the same chance to get into those events, because everyone is starting essentially on the one-year list from zero. The Masters uses a two-year list, and of course there are some players who are coming onto the circuit, you know, the first year of a two-year card who don't have the previous year's points, so they're at a disadvantage. That's one reason. I personally don't see how the prestige of the Masters could be increased by making it a ranking event. I don't think most people who watch snooker on TV really, frankly, care about that sort of stuff. They're going to see the top 16 in the world. What does it matter if they're ranking points? The Masters has become, to my mind, the second biggest tournament on the circuit in terms of its sort of importance, its prestige, every match a final and all of that. However, there are arguments. You talk to some players to say, why not just make everything a ranking event? Because pretty much everything is now. You know, even the Shootout, you know, controversially, is a ranking tournament. So there's an argument to make it one. The problem with that, of course, is what you're effectively doing is rewarding players who already have an advantage in terms of where they are in the rankings. If you're in the top 16 and you get extra ranking points in a tournament no one else is playing in outside the top 16, that seems a bit unfair. So there are arguments for and against. Personally, I would just leave it as it is. Matt Owen writes, something that I've been meaning to email you about for a while but never seemed to have gotten round to. When the listener in last week's podcast criticising Ronnie O'Sullivan's off-table behaviour spurred me into finally putting pen to paper, or keystroke to screen, or whatever. Yeah, just to break in. Yeah, we had an email quite critical of Ronnie O'Sullivan's behaviour. I kind of defended him, or really I just sort of put my own perspective on my dealings with him and what I've observed. Let's be clear, you know, he's done things that have been controversial. But I made the point that he has these quite violent mood swings and that has affected his behaviour. I also made the point that as a player, you know, he's brought a lot of interest to snooker, and personally I think that dwarfs all the controversy. Anyway, back to Matt's email. He says, it struck me that the potential life cycle of the professional snooker player far exceeds that of almost any other sport. In Ronnie's case, to be at the elite level of a sport and with all the external pressures that entails for a quarter of a century is surely unprecedented. Most sports stars' careers don't exceed a decade at the very top. In terms of practice, discipline and then tournament play, to live your life in this manner for such a protracted period must be extraordinarily demanding. That is not even to mention the pressures of the media, the glare of the public eye, and in Ronnie's case, being essentially the talisman for the sport for 25 years. My uneducated take is that unless you are made of quite stern stuff, then this is bound to take its toll on you. We can't know what it is like to have that pressure and expectation heaped on you for so long. So it's hardly surprising that Ronnie dips out of tournaments occasionally or threatens to retire. The pressure on him, particularly if you are of a delicate mindset, must be relentless. Personally, I find Ronnie's behaviour more or less completely understandable. In fact, in Ronnie's case particularly, more so than, say, Mark Williams and John Higgins, he should be cut some slack. He has, for the most part, been a fine ambassador for the sport, despite quite public problems with mental health. There is no one that has dealt with what he has for so long, and far from being criticised, he should actually be applauded. Many thanks, and long may this podcast continue. It really is the highlight of my week. Perhaps that says more about me than I would like. And Alpha Bonzi, regular correspondent, is also writing in about the same subject. He says, a quick defence of Ronnie O'Sullivan. Although your correspondent was right to point out some undignified things he said and done, you probably couldn't count how many pairs of eyes he's brought to the game, summed up by a quick 90-second montage from the 93 UK win to sixth world title, including two Crucible Maximums, the Thousand Centuries, those clearances in the 2012 World Final, and the Tour Champs Semi in 2019, and much more. I do sympathise with the other correspondent's disappointment with the format. I'm sorry, we've moved on to a new subject here. He says, I do sympathise with your other correspondent's disappointment with the format of the new and improved British Open, and I reckon the problem could be solved by ditching the flawed current 1-8 in round one at the venue and go back to the 2010-12 system, which saw the top 16 of that cut-off period seeded through to the venue joined by 16 qualifiers. So much simpler to follow, plus it gave the top 16 a reward for being the top 16 without giving them the season-long ranking protection of the pre-Hearn era. That's a separate issue. Listen, that's a perfectly valid argument. I don't think that's going to happen. I think World Snooker Tour have dug their heels in with the flat draws. I think the point you make about O'Sullivan is spot on. The amount of people he's brought to the game, I think, dwarfs, you know, these sort of quite annoying at times things that he's done, but that's all they are, really. It's just noise. It doesn't really add up to that much, I don't think. Luke Bishop writes, I've just returned to the UK from 2 years in Melbourne, and I was outraged to discover that there's no statue of the local hero and world champion, the Thunder from Down Under himself, Neil Robertson. Despite being a sport-mad people, most Melburnians were even unaware when the World Championship was taking place, instead focusing their attentions on their version of the game, involving dozens more players, a lot fewer balls, no table, singlets instead of waistcoats, and significantly more violence. I'm guessing he means Aussie rules football. Although I enjoy the novelty of watching Ronnie win a world title in the middle of the night, I'm glad to be back in the UK and hope to add to my paltry one visit to the Crucible, despite living within 40 miles of it for my whole life. Now, I'm going to break in here. There's a diversion here about a player who he saw didn't wash his hands after going to the toilet, and the speculation what that would do to the cloth. If you don't mind, Luke, I'm going to gloss over that because it's a little ripe. You know, there might be people driving along with their children in the back or whatever. So we're just going to slightly gloss over that. But it's an interesting point, but let's leave it there. He says, in conclusion, keep up the good work and go Geelong Cats. It might be Geelong Cats. I don't know anything about Aussie rules at all. The greatest team of them all, he says. And then he says, P.S. I've just read that Robbo supports the Collingwood. In which case, his snubbing by the Melbourne authorities is completely justified, and I retract my previous outrage. I think we've stumbled into we've stumbled into an area maybe we should stumble out of there. Christian Thomasberger writes, I'd like to ask you today, what do you know about the origin of Ronnie's nickname? I know he has many of them, but what do you know about the origin of the Rocket? I'm asking you because well-informed snooker commentator Rolf Kalb always emphasises that it has its origin not from his speedy playing style, but rather has been used originally more or less as a metaphor for his extraordinary climbing in the rankings. That wasn't seen before in snooker. What do you possibly know about that? I know that it's maybe hard to tell which meaning was first used, and if you think it's impossible by now, tell me. But as you are one elite journalist in snooker, maybe you can remember a very early newspaper article about that topic, or have you spoken to someone who remembers one? Well, I don't know absolutely, Christian, but the fact is, snooker nicknames initially came into being really to put on exhibition posters, and they were highly alliterative, i.e. Hurricane Higgins, Whirlwind White. So Rocket Ronnie makes sense from that perspective. I don't know that it was Alan Hughes who came up with it. Alan Hughes was the MC for a long time. One of the great people in the game, actually. One of the funniest. I mean, there's very few people who've made me laugh more than Alan down the years. He did a great job. He was an old showbiz type. You know, he'd had a showbiz career. He actually had a football career. Went into showbiz as a master of ceremonies, a compere. And, you know, was the MC, master of ceremonies at snooker for many years. And he came up with a lot of these nicknames. Now, I think almost certainly Alan would have come up with this. And again, it just sort of rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? You want that last sort of line of your intro to roll off the tongue, Rocket Ronnie. It does actually represent his playing style a little bit. It suggests dynamism. It suggests something explosive. It suits him down to the ground. It's a perfect nickname, I think, for Ronnie O'Sullivan. So that would be my best guess, that Alan Hughes came up with it. Now then, there may be people out there who will claim it themselves. Maybe, oh no, I had the idea or whatever. I don't know for sure. Alan popularised it. And of course, a lot of the MCs that have come since, people like Rob Walker, Phil Seymour, they've had to kind of inherit. They can't suddenly call Ronnie something different. So they've inherited some of these nicknames, and they've come up with a few of their own, I'm sure, as well. But they've been sort of passed down, and it's obviously, you know, it's one that people just all immediately associate with him. So my best guess is that it was Alan Hughes, and essentially it's because it's alliteration, Rocket Ronnie. It makes perfect sense, but it also does sum up his sort of playing style as well. Final email is from James Heat. He says, now this is, we've been talking about the format for the British Open, of course, it's best of fives early on. And James writes this, and he is, I think, pretty much spot on here. He says, I think the British Open has a short format because there seems to be a maximum of four tables in operation at once during this season. In the Home Nations events, they managed to keep the matches at the usual length because they played most of the first round earlier in the season, i.e. qualifiers. The British Open, they're playing all the matches in 7 days, so the matches have to be very short to be able to play all the matches with only four tables. Yeah, that's it, James. There has still been no official explanation from World Snooker Tour, and I think that's a mistake. I was talking to a player last week who actually said what I'd said, which is, look, if they just told us, if they gave us a reason, we might find it easier to accept. The fact there's been nothing said continues to be, I think, quite damaging, actually, because it just allows people to come up with their own theories. But this four-table thing is interesting. They've got a deal with a streaming company. They have to provide streaming of every table. And what they found is that, economically, the best model is four tables. They did it at the Pro Series. That was, in the scheme of things, quite a low-key event, that Pro Series last season. It ran for several weeks. But actually, they made money on it. They made money on it through the streaming of the four tables. So they've worked out this is the best economic model. And therefore, you're quite right. If they don't have pre-qualifying, and with a random draw, you can't really have pre-qualifying because, you know, you're going to have like Selby Murphy playing in the qualifier somewhere. So without pre-qualifying, they've got to jam all the matches in. Now, they could possibly still play best of sevens, but best of fives it is. There are rights and wrongs with this, I think. World Snooker Tour are ultimately a commercial body, and they are there actually in part not just to run the tour, but to make money. And the two go together. Obviously, you need the finances to run the tour. The fact is, this is a new event. It's 100,000 first prize. And a lot of that money has come from, you know, careful stewardship of the game. Making money is not a sin at all. It's one of the things, actually, they're charged to do. The payoff, though, is you end up with a format that a lot of players don't like. But this was another discussion I was having with a player who was complaining about not just this, but a lot of things. And so I was sort of listening to him. This was at Championship League last week. I was sort of thinking, you don't get it, do you? Because actually, you can be the best snooker player in the world. You can be the best snooker player ever. But if there isn't the commercial structure around the game, you're not going to make a living. It doesn't mean anything. It's like being, a comparison would be, being the best billiards player in the world. Okay, I'm talking English billiards here. You could be a genius at billiards, but there isn't a professional circuit, anything like the snooker circuit with all the money. So just being brilliant at it, it doesn't mean anything unless you've got that commercial underpinning where you can win all these big money prizes. We sort of had it in snooker a little bit going back nearly two decades when the game wasn't being well run. We only had six ranking tournaments. So even though you had genius players, they weren't being given the opportunities that their talent deserved. You know, think of how many more titles people like Ronnie O'Sullivan, Higgins, Williams, all those guys. I mean, they've won plenty, don't get me wrong. Think how many more they would have won had there been more tournaments. Stephen Hendry as well. Stephen Hendry, if there are as many ranking events now as there were... Sorry, if there are as many ranking events when he was playing as there are now, he would have won, I'm sure, over 50. I'm sure he would. But the game wasn't as well run then. So in order to maximise your ability on the table, you need that commercial structure around it. So things like this, although players... And I understand it from players' perspective, not liking the best of fives. And there's an argument to say they could have... If they're going to go with this four-table model, because it's commercially viable, they could have at least made them best of sevens. There's an argument to say that. But you've got to look at it and say, well... It's either we do it this way, or maybe we don't have the tournament at all, and then we're a tournament down, and then we don't have the chance to earn the money. It's a difficult one. I think always you have to look at, in sport, what's kind of protecting the sort of dignity of the sport against commercial imperatives. Some sports do that better than others. I think snooker does it pretty well. And let's be clear, when people complain about television, every tournament on the calendar has been brought into life because of television. That's the only reason this professional tour exists how it does. It's for television. Even the World Championship, that's the only event that predates television, but the format has been moulded to suit television, to give BBC 2 weeks of coverage. So, okay, it's not ideal, maybe, for everyone, but it's kind of... players tend to look at things entirely from their own perspectives, which is understandable because they're snooker players. I suppose they don't need to see the other side of it. But the other side of it is quite simple. It doesn't matter how good you are at snooker, if there's not a commercial structure around the sport that enables you to make money, you're not going to. You're not going to earn a good living. And that's the trade-off, and that's the thing I think players need to look at. Although I totally understand when they come into a tournament and the matches are this short, they think, well, this is not a proper test of my ability. I do understand that, but it's a trade-off. And I don't see this necessarily continuing in this format, as James Heat, the correspondent there, says. Home nations, they're having pre-qualifying. That will be to essentially play some of the less glamorous matches in qualifying setups. The top players will be held over, so you'll still see them at the venue. They'll be best of seven. I'm going to make a prediction now, okay? Feel free to record this and play it back in a year's time if it backfires. My prediction is this format will not be repeated. There will not be another best of five tournament next year. I think actually World Snooker Tour, although they've said nothing about it, I think they will listen, and I think next year it will be slightly different, possibly with pre-qualifying of some kind. Listen, let's just hope the British Open's on again. That's the most important thing. Just before we move on to my chat with Phil Yates about the first round draw of the British Open, one player who's not going to be there is Jamie O'Neill. Now, it was reported recently on the World Snooker Tour website that he has withdrawn from the tournament and been replaced with Dylan Emery. That's all it said. I thought it was a bit odd that no details were given, so I looked into it. It turns out Jamie O'Neill has been suspended. He's been suspended for his behaviour at one of the tournaments at Milton Keynes last year. Now, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of what happened and what he did and all the rest of it, I find it rather odd that wasn't just reported as a fact. I mean, he's not playing in the tournament because he can't. To say he's withdrawn, I mean, technically and semantically, you could get away with it because he'd entered and now he's not in it. So, okay, he's withdrawn. But really, he's not playing because he can't play. It's like saying, oh, yeah, I'm not going to that party on Saturday night. No, I'm not going. It turns out no one's invited you to it. The disciplinary process is a little bit too murky for me. It's murkier than in a lot of other sports. This is one area where snooker lags behind other sports that just openly report and document disciplinary cases. In snooker, a lot of them seem to be hidden away, and if it's not transparent, then it leads to people maybe feeling that they've got something to hide. Now, I'm not suggesting they do, but don't say he's withdrawn when he's suspended. That's the reason he can't play in the tournament. And really, it leads to a couple of questions. The first is, where is the press statement detailing why he's been suspended? How many tournaments has he been suspended for? And for what reason? And number two, who else has been disciplined that we don't know about? What other, maybe even withdrawals from tournaments, are put down to the fact that players can't play? Why not just be upfront about it? I find this, as I say, a bit sort of disingenuous to make it look like he's withdrawn as if he's got a cold, but actually he's not allowed to play in the event because he's suspended. I don't get why that can't just be expressed honestly. Because, you know, in the scheme of things, with the greatest respect to Jamie O'Neill, it's not a big deal that he's been suspended. He's not a top eight player. He probably wouldn't make hardly any column inches anywhere, but it should still be reported up front and honestly, surely. Surely that's how disciplinary matters should be conducted. I just found it a bit odd that it was sort of put away as a withdrawal when, you know, he can't play in the tournament because he's been suspended from the tour. Anyway, we are proud members of the Sports Social Network. Do check out their other podcasts. You can email us anytime at snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. In the meantime, here is myself and Phil Yates looking at the great moments of the British Open. So, Phil, the British Open is almost upon us. There's been a lot of chat, hasn't there, about the format, the best of five format. We've spoken to a lot of players. Let's be honest, quite a few are not happy, which I can understand from a player's perspective because, obviously, you know, they're very short matches. You're playing for your livelihood and all the rest of it. But not all of them are unhappy. We've spoken to some who are quite happy about it. I think some lower down the rankings actually feel maybe they've got a slightly better chance against the top players. But it is short, the format.
You're right to put in that disclaimer about the fact we're not players, so we come from a completely different perspective, of course. What I will say is this. In best of sevens, when they were introduced, there were moans there. And what happened was the lower-ranked players who struggled to get over the line in best of nines would find a barrier at three. So maybe they'll find a barrier at two in this. And you make a really good point. We were talking before about the tournament in Glasgow, the ranking event, where it was predominantly best of fives. And look at the final there. It was Neil Robertson against Ronnie O'Sullivan. I still think you'll get the usual suspects contesting the latter stages. Obviously, I would be totally remiss to remove any possibility of a greater amount of shocks. I think there will be. But one of the great aspects of the tour, from an observational standpoint right now, is the variety it has. And of course, there are plenty of other best of 11, best of 9 tournaments, best of 7 tournaments, and the World Championship as well, which is on its own. So I've got no objection to best of 5s as such. And I think there's a salient point here. If this was an established tournament that already had a best of 9 or 11 format and it was reduced to best of 5s, I think the complaints might be a little more valid. Here you've got a brand new tournament, well, reintroduced after 17 years, with a first prize of £100,000, I really can't see the problem.
Yeah, I think you're right to say, obviously, the British Open does have a history that has a completely different format, so maybe it would have been a better idea to call it something else, although the British Open, as a sort of brand, if you like, is very strong. I was talking to a player at the Championship League, and this sort of goes back to what I always said about this, is that he actually said what I've been saying, which is if they just told us the reason, we might actually accept it. But no one said anything. World Snooker have not said a word about why it is this format. And so therefore, conspiracy theories run right. You know what it's like in the players' room when they start sort of chatting. And I mean, one player said to me, oh, yeah, he said this was their plan all along. They introduced the best of sevens to soften us up for the... I mean, it's all nonsense. But if you're not told the reason, any reason, then this sort of chat happens. Anyway, the format is what it is. Tickets are selling well, which is good news. And I guess that's the test of it, ultimately. You know, how many people turn up and through the door? I had a tweet the other day from a guy, never been to snooker, watched snooker 35 years, never been to snooker. He's coming to Leicester to watch the British Open for the, you know, first live snooker ever. So it works for him.
Yeah, well, you're going to get, in the early days of the tournament, and by the way, I'm really looking forward to the event, I must say. In the early days of the tournament, you're going to get three sessions. You're going to get four players in each session on all four tables. So if you come on the Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday, you're going to see 48 different players if you're in the right position in the crowd to see all four tables at the same time. I think it's going to be phenomenal value for spectators. And I think it's worth making a point as well, Dave, that a lot of the players involved in the British Open weren't involved at the Crucible. So they'll be back playing in front of a crowd for the first time in ages.
Snooker's not short of moaners. We're two of them, actually. But I do feel with this... And I remember when the Champion of Champions started, that before a ball was struck, people were trying to find fault with it. If it wasn't the format, it would be something else. It's the wrong time of year, it's the wrong venue, it's the wrong this, it's the wrong that. Listen, it's a snooker tournament, we're going to enjoy it. And let's get on with just looking through the draw, which of course has been made. First random draw in the British Open since 1992. There were three from 1990 to 92, as we discussed last week when we sort of went through all the events. Before we get into the draw, again, you know, you hear people saying, oh, well, of course, it was all rigged, it was all fixed, because there are some glamour ties here. It wasn't fixed. We know Roddy and Ivan from World Snooker Tour did it. I mean, you know, the idea that those two are involved in some grand conspiracies is literally a joke. If you know those two, you know it's been done honestly. Here's the thing, though, like, I think we sort of live in an age of conspiracy, don't we? People just look for conspiracies in everything. Things can just happen. Things can just happen randomly. You know, the world actually... Here's the truth. The world runs on chaos, you know. And why shouldn't matches like this be pulled out? And also, these conspiracy theorists don't think it through. Mark Selby, Sean Murphy, that's the first match we're going to talk about. Mark Selby's from Leicester. To an extent, he's selling this event. You know, he's going to bring people in every day. If Will Snooker were going to fix it, they would give him a match he would definitely win, because they want him in the tournament. The idea that, you know, they would put him against Sean Murphy and possibly go out on day one is ridiculous. But let's talk about that match. I mean, obviously, this was the world final. That was a four-session, two-day, you know, epic. This is going to be short and sweet, one way or the other.
Absolutely. I think it's a great televisual event immediately out of the gate. But I agree with you. I think that I would have preferred them to be kept apart. You know, over the best of fives, I think we're defeating our own argument a little by saying this, but over the best of fives, Murphy and Selby, I mean, toss a coin. If Murphy plays like he did at the World Championship, I think he's got a really good chance, obviously. I just wonder, though, because he plays a lot of golf and he enjoys his life, whether he's going to be as prepared for the tournament as Mark Selby is. And maybe that difference will be the key.
Do the tactics change in a best of five? Because obviously the best of 35 world final, you could be 3-0 down. It's no great trauma in this. If you're 3-0 down, you're at the tournament. So, I mean, they play different ways, don't they, obviously? But would either of them sort of change their approach, do you think?
Certainly not to individual frames, no. I think where a player might be at a disadvantage if they're a notoriously slow starter, and we have those on the tour, we all know about that. I think, though, when it comes to a frame of snooker, whether it's a best of 35 or the first frame or second frame of a best of five, it's going to be exactly the same in terms of their approach to it. I just think that if one of them gets on top, I mean, you know how good they can play, and this applies to all of the matches, it could be over in half an hour.
Bit of deja vu for them, because of course they here in Leicester, you know, we go back 25 years as juniors, they would play each other at Willie Thorne's every Sunday in this sort of length of matches. Obviously not as significant, although then it probably felt as significant as they were sort of dreaming of progressing in their careers. But you just couldn't sort of pick a winner, could you? I mean, I don't think being in Leicester makes any difference really. You know, Mark Selby will have support, but it's very hard to say who's going to come through that. Murphy will have played, obviously, in the Championship League. Mark Selby hasn't played, but he'll have practised, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, Murphy will take that as just a match where he plays his usual game. That's him. I just fear slightly for Mark Selby, in the sense that he might think, best of five, best be cautious, and maybe go into his shell a little, because when he does that, we all know he's not as effective as when he plays a little more fluently. I'm not saying he's going to be like a whirlwind or a hurricane, but when he plays expansive snooker, which we know he can at a very high level, that's when he's really at his most dangerous. Obviously, he's got the ability to park the bus and to play defensively when he has to. But I think if he goes into a match with a premeditated idea, I need to be cautious here, that's when he could trip himself up.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting being in Leicester to see. I mean, I presume he's going to have like his wife and maybe his daughter and from friends, family coming down to see him. That can put extra pressure on. It can motivate, but obviously you want to perform for them. So we'll see. I mean, it's very, very hard to call. Let's be honest. The headline from the draw was Mark Allen, Rhian Evans. Now, it's unusual for a man to play a woman in any sport, really. It doesn't happen that often. But obviously they have a very particular backstory. It's private between them, but it's become public. There's they had a relationship when they were younger. They had a child together. There has been a dispute over maintenance payments. That there's a court issue. At the World Championship, Mark Allen asked for Rhiann Evans to leave the practice room when she was working for the BBC so he could practice. And now they're going to play each other. Now, it's a very uncomfortable situation for both, not least because it's obviously live on TV.
Well, when I heard the draw, I was absolutely dumbfounded. And you've got competing sort of thoughts in your mind here. First off, I did feel a little sorry for Mark Allen, actually. It's, for him, as you say, that's the best word, uncomfortable. Obviously, based on pure snooker ability, he should be a big favourite to win the match. But over the best of five, Rhiann Evans is more than capable of beating anyone. What I will say is, and I know Mark would take this in the right way, from a purely television and interest point of view, media-wise, that is an unbelievable draw, isn't it?
Mm.
It's going to create so much interest, not from the normal snooker channels either. I think it's going to be a crossover event, if you like. So, in that regard, it was a wonderful draw for the game, but clearly, for Rhiann and Mark, not the best draw at all for either of them.
No, I mean, you know, there is this backstory which cannot be ignored. This is not just another snooker match, but ultimately all they're going to be doing is playing snooker. I would ask people to remember one thing. There is their daughter involved in this as well, who's completely innocent, and, you know, her thoughts should be remembered as well. You know, people sort of quite gleeful about the draw, but there are other people involved. It's going to be an uncomfortable evening, that is, one way or another. Whatever happens, really, I think both of them will just be happy when it's over.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's one of those situations that, well, I mean, we use the word in sport a lot, unprecedented, when sometimes it's an exaggeration. This really is unprecedented. I think the best thing that Mark can do is come over, play the match, and, you know, see what happens on the table. That's where I'll be concentrating my thoughts as to what occurs there. But clearly the outside world will be viewing it from a very different perspective.
Be interested to see what World Snooker Tour do from a media perspective, because I imagine there'll be a lot of requests for journalists to come. Now, there may be, you know, with COVID sort of restrictions, perfectly good reasons not to let them in, but that's going to be, it's a little bit like kind of the 80s, isn't it? You know, when news reporters would come and report Alex Higgins and that sort of thing. We haven't really had that sort of thing for a while. But anyway, that's not up to us. That's up to the aforementioned people who did the draw. Okay, well, that's going to create a lot of interest. But there's a lot of other really interesting matches, I think, in this draw. Trump's got Mitchell Mann, who's... And he did a really interesting, very revealing interview with Phil Hague from the Metro, a typical Phil Hague interview, lots of detail in there, talking about his various addictions he's had in his life, which have been very debilitating, because he's the same age as Trump. They came up together effectively in the junior ranks. One has soared to the top of the game. The other has sort of struggled, really. And Mitchell Mann was saying, you know, he feels he's sorted himself out and time is still on his side. He can still actually make an impact. Not easy, though, when you draw the world number one in round one.
Well, this is it, you see. I think not just for this draw, which is completely open, but in a lot of tournaments, time after time after time, the lower-ranked players, as they once were playing each other, are now playing the top guys. And if you get a succession of very, very tough draws, it can lead to a draining of confidence and your whole season being undermined. So I think it's a case of be careful what you wish for those lower-ranked players. If they were playing each other in qualifiers to get through to play the top 16 in the last 32, as it used to be, that's a very different scenario from now. But one thing I will say about Mitchell Mann, we all know what he's capable of. And again, I'll repeat, over the best of five frames, he could beat anyone.
I always feel that with Trump, and I certainly felt this last year in Milton Keynes, because obviously it was the same venue, same arena. That TV table, it's like his table. You know, it's like, come on, okay, who's next? Come on, play me next, and let, you know, I'll beat you as well. That, even though it is a short match, the TV, you know, environment suits Trump massively. But of course, we don't know. We don't know how he's going to perform. It's early season for everybody. You know, he's quite rightly been off on holiday. Why shouldn't he be? Sort of getting back into it. But let's be honest, and people sort of maybe don't like to talk about this, but I think we should. Money's a motivator for everybody, and this is a big tournament. 100 grand first prize, you know, early in the season. People haven't earned money for a while. He'll be up for it, Trump.
Absolutely, and rightly so. He wants to win titles. The more he wins, the more he wants to win.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm just going to go off on a tangent here. We talk about people moaning. You hear people moaning all the time, the lower-ranked players, about, oh, Judd Trump and Ronnie O'Sullivan, they're on the main match table all the time. And that is the correct thing to do because they are the needle movers. They are the ratings getters. No doubt about it. If you put Trump on an outside table, O'Sullivan, and you've got a match that is of lesser interest to the wider snooker public, it's bad for everyone in the game because you want to maximise your figures and you want to maximise the interest in the tournament in general. So that's just a little tangent there.
Oh, you're right. No, listen, you're right. And some a player, I remember a few years ago, a player said to me, everyone should have an equal chance to play on the main table. Well, the truth is, everyone has an equal chance to win the World Championship. Ronnie O'Sullivan's won it six times, Trump's won it, and everything else he's won. That's why they're on there, because they're at the top of the game.
Yeah, I remember on one occasion at Plymouth Pavilions, they decided, because there was a lot of unrest with the players, this is probably nearly 30 years ago now, a lot of unrest with the players, that they weren't going to put Jimmy White on. He was playing against Dominic Dale on an outside table. Everyone flocked to that outside table, and there was no one around the main match table. It was a good match, actually. But there was no one around the main match table. It happened at the Welsh Open years later in Cardiff when, unbelievably, they put Stephen Hendry and Jimmy White on an outside table in favour of a Welsh player out in the main match arena. It doesn't work. End of story. It doesn't work. The point is, it is unfair. Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. But life's unfair.
Yeah, I mean, that is an example of some crazy decisions. It reminds me of something the late Terry Wogan said about BBC management. He said their motto is, if it ain't broke, break it. Anyway, we'll move on because I think for snooker fans, OK, there's some headline acts there, but for snooker fans, there's some really interesting matches. And, you know, if you come along, you get a chance to see, you know, all these potentially in the same day. John Higgins, much slimmer John Higgins than we saw last season. He's lost 2.5 stone. He's going to spinning classes in Glasgow 3 times a week. He says he goes to basically an industrial estate. They play loud music. You cycle for 45 minutes. You sweat, you know, loads, but you lose weight. 2.5 stone. He looks good, doesn't he? And he's playing Alexander Ersenbacher. That's a really interesting match.
Well, Ersenbacher, when he's 3 matches out of 3 to qualify from the first phase of the Championship League, didn't lose a single frame. I thought he was absolutely sensational. John Higgins, although he didn't get through in the Championship League, played very nicely, just that he ran into a buzzsaw by the name of Nopon Sankam, who played superbly. Yeah, it seems as though the Higgins practice regime has done him a lot of favours, and I was talking to Stephen Maguire, actually, about this, and Stephen was telling me that John intends to continue as the season progresses, and so it's not just a close season, sort of short, sharp fitness regime. He's going to carry on with it.
Yeah, well, I spoke to him, and you could see he was just kind of, like, he's happier just for having done it. You know, it's an achievement, you know, because you get older, you get lazier, and you kind of think, OK, I'm just going to kind of this, I'll just put on weight, you know, the rest of my life sort of thing. But actually, he's sort of made a conscious decision. I don't think he's ever really massively been into fitness, so it's quite a big thing to do. He looks healthier, he looks happier, and, you know, we know what a great player he is. That's not in doubt. So, of course, he's the last winner of the tournament as well. He's sort of technically the defending champion.
Well, he was chuckling last week as I mentioned that. I said, here he is, the defending British Open champion, and he thought it was rather absurd. Of course, there was a debate, actually, about whether, had it been a normal structured draw, whether he would have been the number one seed. Matt Seltz said the same thing, actually. If the Indian Open comes back on the calendar, will he be the number one seed? It's an interesting little niche argument.
Yeah.
Didn't really come into play here, but I think John's got a great chance. He's got a great chance in any tournament he plays in. Let's put it this way. If he plays like he did at the Players' Championship, give him the trophy now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, he shares the record for most British Open wins with Stephen Hendry, who's also in the draw. Now, Hendry won this title, what, 33 years ago for the first time. He's got Chris Wakelin, who did quite an interesting good interview on the World Snooker Tour website, where he said very innocently, he wasn't, you know, wasn't sort of trying to wind anyone up. He said, "Oh yeah," he said, "I'm too young to remember Hendry in his prime, but my mother used to love him," you know, which is kind of tells you how long Hendry's been going. I'm happy he's in this though, Stephen, because last year, you know, he was given this tour card. We didn't see him for months. He decided not to play. I don't think he liked the behind closed doors thing. But if he's going to do anything, he's got to be playing as much as the other guys. So it's good to see him in this.
I really hope I get to commentate on that match. It'll be a case of nostalgia for me. I'm a massive Stephen Hendry fan, if you didn't already know.
Spoiler alert.
I just would love to see him play a couple of really good matches like the old days. We saw Jimmy White actually in the Championship League play one really good contest against Sean Maddox. He flew around the table, he made three lovely breaks, and it was so gratifying to see. And I think it would be exactly the same emotion if Hendry did the same at the British Open.
But I think it's a really interesting match, actually a good draw in terms of seeing where his game is, because Chris Wakelin, he's not at the very top of the game, but he can play the game. He's a very solid professional, and we know that the strength and depth in the game has improved. Stephen Hendry playing, I'm not absolutely sure where Chris is ranked actually, but say he's like 60. If Stephen had played the world number 60 30 years ago, he'd be a certainty. Now, by no means anyone would be a certainty against them.
Well, I haven't seen the odds for the tournament yet, but I would hazard a guess that the bookmakers would make Wakelin favourite, and I would not disagree with that. He's a very capable sort, and if he's been practising a lot, which he normally does because he's also dedicated, I definitely would make him favourite. Having said that, though, if Hendry can rekindle the old magic, well, that's an entirely different thing.
Amazing. Sorry, Phil, I've just looked at... He's world number 60. I've just looked at the rankings. I didn't know that. What about that? It must have been some weird sort of... I don't know. Something weird there.
Subliminal statage.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, that's... I think it's an interesting one just to test. If Hendry had come in against Trump, you know, you can't... maybe couldn't really see where his game was, but that's... It's a winnable match, but it's a tough match. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing him. And then some other real sort of standouts. I mean, these are matches that, you know, we hope to see on TV because they're the sort of matches snooker fans, I think, will really enjoy. Barry Hawkins, Luca Brasel. Luca Brasel is a player who I constantly feel should be higher in the rankings than he is. We know he had trouble a couple of years ago and all the rest of it. Barry Hawkins, you know, the solid, all the rest of it, all these sort of compliments that aren't quite compliments for him. Really good player, bottom line.
Absolutely. I think that's intriguing. And I think Luca Brasel is just the kind of player... I'm not going to say he's going to do this because you can't make any predictions for this tournament, but he's the kind of player, if he got on a roll, I think he could go all the way. When I see him play well, I think, how is he not right ensconced in the world's top 10? But of course, you've just heard about Barry Hawkins being consistent, which he is. That's Brasel's problem. He's inconsistent. Mm. But I will say this, he's got one thing going for him. He's high, he's very high.
This is why, though, it's difficult to predict the win of the tournament, because normally you'd look at the draw at the start and say, OK, well, I think, you know, Mark Williams has got a good draw, or Mark Selby, whatever. We don't know who's going to draw who in the next round, because it's random, so that makes it more of a leveller, maybe. Another match, again, which is kind of, you know, sort of proper snooker fans match, I think, Stuart Bingham, Robert Milkins, that's sort of... match that, you know, I don't think Bingham would be punching the air at that draw. That's, you know, Rob Milkins again, certainly in any format, but certainly the best of five, could give him real trouble.
Well, he could give him real trouble, and he could send Bingham back in 30 minutes, and that's something that Bingham is well aware of. Yeah. He's the kind of player, much like Brasel, who you don't want to draw in this format, because they can make quick starts, and all of a sudden, bish-bash-bosh, handshake. What I will say is that I was very impressed with Stuart Bingham in the first stage of the Championship League. He got through his group. He made some big breaks, but in each match, he made a really superb clearance at just the right time. Now, that tells me his game's in pretty good shape. And, of course, he's desperate to go back up the rankings and re-establish himself as one of the game's totally leading players. So I think he'll be highly motivated, and I think that's a match that I'll certainly be watching with great interest.
You mentioned Jimmy White earlier. Of course, he's won the British Open twice back in the day, 87 and 92. He played somebody who wasn't alive, wasn't even close to being alive then, Aaron Hill. Of course, last I'm sure Aaron Hill is proud of beating Ronnie O'Sullivan last season at the European Masters, but he doesn't want forever to be remembered for that, obviously. He wants to move on. You know, we talk about James Cahill beating Ronnie at the Crucible. What have we really mentioned about him since? I mean, he's dropped off the tour, you know, so he's sort of battling. He's in this event, but he's battling to get his tour card back. So Aaron Hill almost has got to sort of put that to one side, which I'm sure he's trying to do. But always when you get a new player against, let's be honest, the oldest player on the circuit, that's an interesting clash. Jimmy will have so much support, but he's got his work cut out. And maybe, you know, Aaron Hill, because he hasn't grown up literally watching Jimmy's great moments, won't sort of have the same reverence maybe that some of the older players might have for him.
I'm sure that's absolutely correct. The win over O'Sullivan was terrific. He's got a great amateur career behind him, Aaron Hill. So let's hope he kicks on this season. I think with Jimmy, though, you know, he's been there forever. 40-odd seasons on the tour, turned professional in 1980. And yet, he's still very nervous when he plays. Mm-hmm. He'll go into that tournament knowing he could make an impact. And I think his biggest opponent will be himself.
That's absolutely true. I think that's right. Jimmy, it means more to him than ever now, I think, playing on TV, certainly. Obviously, for years, 25 years, he kind of took it for granted. You know, I'm going to be out in the main arena and loved it. Now, it's becoming sort of rarer. So it's a big deal. And obviously, he's got pride in performance. He's not turning up for the fun of it. He thinks he can still do something. He backs himself. But that puts extra pressure on. So it's sort of catch 22 in a way. If he could relax more and just say to himself, you know, he's got this 2-year card. If he said to himself, right, I'm just going to enjoy playing for these 2 years, maybe that'll be it then maybe the results will come. If he puts too much sort of intensity into it, then he's going to be more edgy, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. We saw this in the Championship League, actually. The match he played very nicely in, really nicely, was the last match when he couldn't top the group. It seemed as though he played with a lot more freedom. And it wasn't just the fact he was knocking in balls. He looked better. He looked less edgy, and the cue action even seemed smoother. So I think it's a case of him of conquering his own sort of self-expectation and going out there and playing with a bit of liberty. If he does that, he's definitely capable of winning matches. And would it be great to see him go deep into the tournament? Because it's the same thing as what we were talking about before with O'Sullivan and Trump being on the main match table. Some people have criticised the fact that White has got a wild card again to play on the tour for 2 years. Give him the wild card. He's massively popular. What harm does it do? What he's done for the game is incredible. But I think even more importantly, commercially, it's a good move because people still love him.
Yeah, and the thing is, okay, this is a snooker podcast, so the listeners will be, in the main, hardcore snooker fans. So they're seeing it almost from the sort of inside out. But you need to see it from the outside in. Snooker needs as much attention as it can get, okay? So things like having Rian Evans on the tour gives it attention. Having Jimmy and Stephen on the tour gives it attention. That's what we need. We need people to be aware of it, you know, who are not hardcore snooker fans. And that will bring, hopefully, more attention, more broadcasting, more sponsorship, all the rest of it. So it might not be strictly fair, but life's not fair. You know, this is a commercial entity, and these things definitely help.
Absolutely. You know, this is a little bit of an example. Back in the day, when Jack Nicklaus played in the Open for the last time, Matthew Syed, who we both know very well, and I respect him greatly, Matthew, he's a phenomenal writer, and 99 times out of 100, I agree with him, but I didn't on this occasion. He said basically that Nicklaus, in an article in the Times this was, Nicklaus shouldn't be there as a ceremonial golfer. He should give his place to someone who's competitive. And I could not disagree more. I was actually there at St Andrews when he walked across the Swilkin Burn onto the bridge there, playing with Tom Watson and Luke Donald. He birdied the last. I was commentating on the interactive service on BBC. And I'm telling you now, quite openly, as he was walking up that 18th fairway, myself and my co-commentator, Dennis Hutchinson, who was a fine player from South Africa who knew Jack well, we let it breathe for about 5, 6, 7 minutes. A, because that was the correct thing to do, but also, we were both crying. It was so emotional. Now, to have Nicklaus there just was one of the great moments of that tournament. And to have Jimmy involved is a great moment every time he plays.
Got to be said, Matthew, he's a great writer. He's a bit of a contrarian, which I don't mind, but yeah, it doesn't surprise me, that story. What about this for a draw, Phil? Graham Dott, Martin Gould. That's a first round match.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, Dottie likes a moan, so there's some fuel there. Well, you know, I'll get all the bad draws.
Gouldy can moan as well, by the way.
Yeah. Well, maybe they should have a moan off, a best of five moan off. Mm. Yeah, I mean, we should do that, Dave. I think we could probably do a best of 19, though. Yeah, I feel a little sorry for both of them because a really good player is going to depart immediately. And let's face it, best of five, those two, you know, it's anyone's.
Yeah. Dean Young was the only player to come through Q School who hadn't been on the tour before. He's done a lot of practice with Scott Donaldson. And, you know, first tournament, apart from the Championship League, a league event, first knockout tournament, he draws Scott Donaldson, which is awkward, isn't it? Because any other draw, they'd be practicing together beforehand. I guess they can't now. And also, there is that sort of, he's got to set aside any sentiment. They both have, actually. Scott would love Dean to do well. Dean obviously supports Scott. That's all got to be forgotten.
Yeah, awkward, but obviously not on the scale of the match we talked about right at the start of the podcast. It was nothing in comparison with that. Yeah, it's a really bad draw for both of them. You know, you've got to draw the positives, as the cliche goes. At least one of them will go into the last 64. And Scott Donaldson has got really good memories of the Morningside Arena because It's where he won the Championship League, his big pro title, so maybe he will galvanise those memories and come good again.
Yeah, good memories apart from nearly dying. But he was taken ill, wasn't he? Some allergic reaction. Thankfully, all was well.
Well, I actually saw him because they stopped that group final. They stopped that for about, I think, 3 or 4 occasions because he was so ill. And I felt so sorry for him. The colour drained out of his face. At one point, he actually had some problems breathing. He felt terribly nauseous and weak. Luckily, though, he was able to recover enough to play the match. And he ended up, funnily enough, beating Graham Dodd 3-0.
Yeah, and Graham, he could have claimed that match, actually, because he's supposed to take 15 minutes, you know, and then you've got to get on playing. And Graham said, no way am I going to claim any frames. You know, his health is more important. Of course, we mentioned Rhianne Evans, that there is another woman in the field, Onyi from Hong Kong, who we hope will come over. She couldn't come over for the Championship League, but we hope to see her for that. She's got David Grace, a listener to this podcast, actually, and you know, one of the great enthusiasts. A tough one. She's tough, though. She's a different sort of player, I think, to Rhianne. She's a very good safety player. And, you know, in a short match, maybe that'll make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Could frustrate opponents, that. She's definitely not the break builder that Rhianne is. Most certainly not. But if she keeps everything tight and wins a frame or two, the other guy will be under an awful lot of pressure. So, Leo, the main thing is, let's hope she can come over and play, because she's been given this tour card because she's in the top two of the women's world rankings, and we need her to come over to start playing events, because if she can't come over until the middle of the season, or, God forbid, late in the season, then basically the tour card doesn't mean a lot.
That's right, yeah. There's some real good matches, actually, here. We've got Show You Long against Tom Ford. Obviously, Tom is a Leicester man. That's a tough draw for him. Fergal, we must mention Fergal O'Brien. He's got Gary Wilson, Michael Holt, Mark Davis. You know, a lot of experience there. So, obviously, there's some headline matches, but you drill down into the draw. Actually, some really good games, and that's going to continue as the tournament goes on. I'm going to make not a wild prediction, but I'm going to name an outsider for the title, Phil. See what you think about this. I think you'll be in agreement, because we've seen him play the Championship League some great stuff. Noppon Senkom, right? Now, we know he's been practising hard, and we were speaking to, I can't remember who it was now, someone was practising with him. Jamie Clark, yeah, who's practising with him. And Jamie said, Jamie's a really good player, and he beat him 16-1 or something. Incredibly.
I swear, folks, honestly, this is not set up in any way. I was thinking, as Dave started that sentence, I'm going to say Noppon Senkom is my outsider. He played brilliantly against John Higgins to win the group decider. He had a century in the first frame, a century in the third, and a really superb colours clearance in the second frame, involving a real pressure blue to a distant ball pocket. He said, actually, in his interview, that's been disputed by all of the players, that he's been practising for 15 hours a day, and I can understand why that was disputed, because it does seem a little far-fetched. Maybe there was a language barrier involved there. But he's certainly been practising a lot. And yes, I would give him a great chance, Senkom. He plays Sean Maddox in the first round. I think he's a big favourite for that. As for my prediction, not an outsider, how about Yan Bingtao? Mm. The reason I'm saying this, he played brilliantly in the first stage of the Championship League. And he's had a month of intense practice. Now, a lot of these guys will have spent a lot of time during the summer on the golf course, so he's got a head start.
Yeah, I think he's obviously a Masters champion, but he'd already won a ranking event. He'd been in finals, and I like the way he plays. He gets under players' skin. He has his own way of playing. He's a bit enigmatic with some of his shot choices. He's good at controlling matches, even with his sort of young years against experienced players. You saw that at the Masters with the three deciders he won. But it's going to be interesting. You know, it's still early season. The matches are short. It's a random draw, so you're not quite sure who's going to play who as it goes along. I'm really looking forward to it, actually. The British Open, it's got a great history, and it's coming back. We'll be here, Phil. We're looking forward to the ITV4 coverage.
Well, look, I'm not saying this because we're involved. It's tremendous coverage. They do such a great job. Neil Cox, the producer, he puts everything into it. Our directors, the whole team. And also, we'll give a shout-out to one particular member of the team, Martin Reardon, who produces segments during the event. He's a VT man par excellence. We're going to do a history piece, I know for sure, that you might want to see when the event starts. Martin Reardon, what a man. He does a great job, and his music choices for those pieces are absolutely spot on. So, every credit.
Now, Martin, Martin's done a trailer with some of the old stuff in. Dickie Davis is in it and all that stuff, so that's for people of a certain age will appreciate that. Yeah, so 16th of August it all starts. Hopefully everyone will enjoy it, and if you're coming along, I hope you enjoy... There's still tickets available. If you're coming along, I hope you enjoy seeing, you know, a lot of different matches, and someone's going to pick up $100,000, so it's going to be a good week for somebody. For now, though, that is it. Thanks for listening, and goodbye. Sports Social Podcast Network.